Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, after such grand topics like the history of gladiators, the AI hype, and Hitler's ascent to power, the last episode, the time has finally arrived for this podcast to tackle a much more modest subject. And that's the question, does the universe have a purpose? And who better to help me tame this giant pickle than Philip Goff, professor of philosophy at Durham University in the UK, author of extremely thought-provoking titles, books such as Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, Galileo's Error, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness, and his last one, Why the Purpose of the Universe. Professor Goff, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on and for that very kind introduction. It's good to be here to chat to you.
Okay, so I gather that the premise or the conclusion of the book that the universe actually might indeed have a purpose wasn't the result of some spontaneous revelation like a mystical experience or perhaps an acid trip or something fun like that. Quite the opposite. The argument you're making is standing on a couple of extremely sturdy and well thought out legs, quote unquote. But since this is not a philosophy nor an astrophysics podcast, I got to be honest about that. We need to grapple with these kind of, I don't want to say elementary, maybe principal concepts first. Otherwise, I'm just going to look like, I'm going to be feeling lost like Burek in space. Sorry, that's a Balkan metaphor, a piece of pie floating in space. So I was thinking it would perhaps be appropriate to begin this exploration with the so-called fine-tuned universe argument or hypothesis. What is the fine-tuned universe?
This is the surprising discovery of recent decades that, at least according to our current scientific theories, for life to be possible, certain numbers in physics had to fall in a certain very, very narrow range, such that on the face of it seems incredibly improbable that you get those exact numbers just by chance. So, I mean, maybe this is clearer with an example. What one of the most discussed examples is that revolves around dark energy, the force that propels the accelerating expansion of our universe. We discovered in 1998 that our universe is not only expanding, but it's accelerating in its expansion. It's getting faster. And we call the force that powers that dark energy. And if you measure what strength that force has, it's quite surprising that if that force was a little bit stronger, everything would have shot apart so quickly that no two particles would have ever met. So you'd have no stars, planets, any kind of structural complexity. On the other hand, if that force had been just a little bit weaker, it wouldn't have counteracted gravity. So the whole universe would have collapsed back on itself a split second after its beginning. So for there to be any kind of life or complexity, that force needed to be kind of like Goldilocks porridge, right? Not too strong, not too weak, just right. And that's just one example. There are many numbers like this that, at least on our current theories, had to be exactly in this very narrow range for any kind of life to be possible. And that's what we call the fine-tuning of physics.
I remember the late Christopher Hitchens, probably the most prominent of the New Atheism members, said in one interview that out of all the arguments for theism, so against atheism, fine-tuning made him, I think he said, the most nervous or something. However, can't we just write off the fine-tuned universe argument by introducing the multiverse hypothesis? So the theory that there is an infinite amount of universes out there, and we just happen to be in the one that has the right parameters, like you described, for supporting life, because we're just lucky like that.
Yeah, just on the Christopher Hitchens video, you can get it on YouTube, I think. It's a very entertaining little video. I think he's quite drunk in the back of a cab talking about the fine-tuning and how he kind of stresses about it. I think Richard Dawkins has said something similar. I remember a conversation between the four so-called horsemen of the new atheism, talking about which argument for God they find most persuasive, even if not persuasive. And I think Richard Dawkins also said the fine tuning. And yes, you're right to raise the multiverse. And to be honest, this is what I used to go for. I always thought fine tuning needed explaining. It just seems too improbable to just be by chance. But I thought the multiverse for a long time seemed like a more plausible explanation, right? So if there are many, many universes, all with slightly different numbers in their physics, then one of them's going to get the right numbers for life just by chance. You know, if enough people buy a lottery ticket, someone's going to get the winning numbers. But I was actually slowly persuaded by philosophers of probability that there is some really dodgy reasoning going on in trying to go from fine-tuning to a multiverse. And, you know, there's been a rich literature on this in the techie philosophy of probability journals for like 30 years. And it's a classic example of academics talking to themselves that, you know, nobody outside of this very specific area of philosophy of probability knows about this stuff, despite actually there's huge interest in this fine-tuning business. So part of what I hope, you know, my book's done is get this discussion, this particular worry about the multiverse, out to a broader audience. But let me try and articulate what the problem's supposed to be. The charge is that trying to explain this fine-tuning in terms of a multiverse commits what's called the inverse gambler's fallacy. So maybe I can explain this with an analogy. I mean, it starts from the regular gambler's fallacy, where someone's been playing in the casino all night, you know, and they've had a terrible run of luck, and you think, "Oh, well, I'm bound to win this time. I've got to have one more go because I've had a run of bad luck. I'm due some good luck." Do you know what I mean? So that's the gambler's fallacy. But the inverse gambler's fallacy is a little bit different. So let me give you an analogy to try and make sense of this. Suppose we go to a casino tonight, and we walk in, and the first thing we see is somebody in the first room winning really big. You know, they're just winning time after time after time. And I turn to you and say, "Hey, Zaza, God, the casino must be very full tonight." And you say, "Philip, what are you talking about? We've just observed this one person winning big. What's that got to do with the rest of the casino?" And I say, "Well, if there are lots and lots of people, tens of thousands of people playing in the casino tonight, then it's not surprising that someone will win big. And that's just what we've observed, someone winning big." Now, everyone agrees that's a fallacy, right? That's the inverse gambler's fallacy, because our evidence is just this one particular individual. And no matter how many people there are or aren't elsewhere in the casino, it doesn't make it any more likely that this one particular individual is going to win big. So that's flawed reasoning. But it looks like someone trying to explain fine-tuning in terms of multiverse is it employing exactly the same kind of reasoning, right? They start off with this one universe. "Oh, it's got the right numbers for life. How incredible. There must be lots of other universes with crap numbers." But that's looks the same problem, right? Our evidence is just this one universe being fine-tuned. That's what constitutes our evidence. No matter how many other universes there are or aren't out there, it has no bearing on how likely it is that this universe is fine-tuned, which is what our evidence is. So I've just slowly become persuaded that sadly you can't explain fine-tuning in terms of a multiverse, and so we have to turn to stranger options, I think.
How does consciousness feature in all this? Or maybe before you address that, do you believe that the question of consciousness is in fact still an open question at all, or has neuroscience kind of pretty much sorted it out? I ask this because I interviewed neuroscientist Anil Seth last year, and he has his own theory. I don't know if you've heard of it. He thinks consciousness is actually an illusion that's being generated by the prediction machine that is our brain, which is always trying to predict what's going to happen next in order to kind of maximize our chances of survival. And the byproduct of this constant kind of stream of predictions is our experience of consciousness, which is ultimately an illusion. That's what he That's what he thinks. Anyway, he seems quite confident in his research. Now, I realize that's only one possible explanation of what consciousness might be, but I thought it points in the direction that maybe we are pretty close to figuring it out. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, people may be interested. I've had, I think, 4 debates with Anil Seth now. Very enjoyable debates. People can find them on YouTube, and I think we've learned a lot from our discussions, and we're very good friends. Actually, we had an evening together in Rome a few weeks ago. We were both filming in a basilica in Rome for the Closer to Truth US PBS show, and we were both filming for that within consecutive days, and so we had a night out in Rome together, which was nice. He's a really lovely guy. We disagree very much, but we get on very well, and we have constructive disagreement, which is what it's all about. Here's what I'd say to start off with. What I am most passionate about, before you get to my view on consciousness or whatever, what I'm most passionate about is that this is not a purely scientific problem. I think it's the science is absolutely crucial. Anil does some wonderful science. But it's also a philosophical problem. At the core of this, we have the ancient challenge that philosophers have traditionally called the mind-body problem, which is the very general challenge of how does consciousness and the physical world fit together? Is the physical world fundamental? You know, physics, chemistry, neuroscience, and maybe consciousness comes out of that? Or is it the other way around? Maybe some story about consciousness is fundamental, and the physical world emerges from some underlying story about consciousness. So it's up the other way around. Or maybe they're both fundamental, but very different. Maybe consciousness is in the soul, and that's just different to the physical workings of the body and the brain. So there are all these philosophical possibilities that philosophers have explored in great detail. Now, here's the crucial point. Each of these options is empirically equivalent, which means you can't do an experiment to work out which is correct, because each of these theories will just give us a different story to how to explain the scientific data. So, you know, what we know scientifically about consciousness, right, is that certain kinds of brain activity go along with certain kinds of conscious experience, right? And we're doing more and more science to try and work out a more specific story about that. You know, you scan someone's brain, you ask them what they're feeling, maybe you stimulate a bit of the brain, and you work out how consciousness is correlated with brain activity. Very important scientific data. But that kind of data is just neutral on all of these different philosophical options on consciousness. You know, all of those theories will just account for that data, but in very different ways. So, I mean, one option is just to say, well, we don't know which is correct. We just have to be neutral. But another option is to say, well, maybe even though we can't do an experiment, maybe there are ways of evaluating these theories independent of experiments. Maybe there's ways we can explore how plausible they are over and above the experiments. It's called philosophy, right? That's what we do with philosophy. We see other ways of working out which of these theories are more plausible. And that's mainly what I've spent my time as a philosopher doing. But look, we just need to work out. I think we're going through a period of history where people are so blown away by the success of science and the wonderful technology it's produced that they think, that's it, right? That's the full story. But sadly, not all of our questions can be answered with an experiment. Sometimes you have to do something a little bit different, and I think that's very much the case with consciousness.
So do you think that science is just going to be able to describe these phenomena better and better, but that's kind of the extent to where it can go? It can't fundamentally address the more existential questions when it comes to, let's say, the universe or consciousness for that matter.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a way of pointing to the reason for this unconsciousness. There's something quite unique about consciousness. Maybe I should have started with this. That it's not a publicly observable phenomenon, right? I can't look inside your brain and see your feelings and experiences. We know about consciousness not from experiments, not from looking down a microscope or a particle collider. You know, we know about consciousness just by being conscious, by being immediately aware of our own feelings and experiences. Now, people, you might say, well, you know, science deals with things you can't observe all the time. You know, fundamental particles, quantum wave functions that physicists talk about, or maybe even other universes we've been talking about a moment ago. But there's a crucial difference with consciousness, because in all these other cases, you're theorizing about things you can't explain in order to explain what you can observe. Sorry, let me say that again. You're theorizing about things you can't observe, like fundamental particles, in order to explain what you can observe, right? That's ultimately the aim of science, right? Explaining experimental observations. In the unique case of consciousness, the thing we are trying to explain is not publicly observable. You can't observe feelings. You know about them because you have them and you're just immediately aware of them. So it's this weird extra thing we know about independent of experiments. But then we've got to put it together with the experiments, right? So we know about feelings because we feel them. But then we know about brains because we study them. And you've got to plug them together somehow. But because it's not publicly observable, you can't pin down the total answers just from doing experiments. So you've just got to explore these different possibilities.
Okay, so what's your view on consciousness then?
So I defend a strange sounding view called panpsychism, that consciousness goes all the way down to the fundamental building blocks of reality. That, so panpsychists needn't think necessarily everything is conscious, but the idea is that the fundamental things that make up our universe are conscious. Maybe fundamental particles like electrons and quarks have incredibly simple forms of conscious experience, and that the very complex experience of the human or animal brain is somehow built up from these simpler forms of conscious experience at the level of fundamental
physics.
Just
to stop you really quick, just to so I can imagine it better. Are we saying that then everything in the universe is suffused with consciousness in a way? Does that mean that, sorry for being so silly, but that my shoe feels something when I put it on?
Not quite, not exactly. It doesn't mean your shoe feels something, but maybe that your shoe is made up of tiny things that feel things.
Okay, that's even more trippy.
But those tiny things, it's not like they feel the kind of things a human being feels, right? It's not like we're saying the electrons are feeling existential angst or wondering if it's Tuesday yet, right? Human consciousness is obviously highly evolved, highly complex, the result of millions of years of evolution. But consciousness comes in all shapes and sizes, right? The consciousness of a sheep is much simpler than that of a human being. The consciousness of a snail is simpler still. As we move to simpler forms of life, we find simpler and simpler forms of conscious experience. So for the panpsychist, this keeps going down, right down to the fundamental building blocks of matter, which have incredibly simple forms of experience, according to panpsychism, to reflect their incredibly simple nature.
How did you arrive at this view?
I get a bit autobiographical in my book, Galileo's Error, which you kindly mentioned earlier about. Well, when I studied philosophy, we were taught that there were only two options, really. Either you thought consciousness was something kind of supernatural in the soul, outside of the body and the brain, or you thought, oh, it's just all just electrochemical signaling, right? And that's it. And I just came to find both of these views deeply problematic. And I thought, I actually wrote my end of degree dissertation saying the problem's unsolvable. And I went on and tried to do something else. But then I just came across this view panpsychism, which is kind of a middle way option. Sounds a bit wild at first, but seems to avoid the deep difficulties of these two traditional options. So maybe focusing on the more traditional option, right? That, well, we can just explain feelings and experiences in terms of electrochemical signaling of the brain, right? A little bit like the way we can explain water in terms of H2O, right? You know, you explain the properties of water in terms of the chemical features of H2O. So one day we'll be able to explain the feelings and experiences, seeing color, hearing sound, feeling love in terms of particular patterns of neural firings in the brain. What's wrong with that? I mean, the first thing to say is we've been trying for many decades now to make progress on that, and that project has gone absolutely nowhere, I would say, which doesn't mean the science of consciousness has gone nowhere. You know, Anil Seth, who we've already discussed, does fantastic science of consciousness. I haven't got any problems with anything he says, but none of it thus far has explained why the brain has consciousness at all. Even a single experience. It's not just that we don't have the full story, but it hasn't managed to explain a single experience. And you might say, and Anil does say, so I'm having the debate here. I'm channeling Anil. Well, we need to give it time. You know, we need to give it time. But what I try to do in my book, Galileo's Error, is take a bit of a broader perspective on the history of science, right? A key moment in the scientific revolution was Galileo's decision in 1623 that, right, from that point on, physics was going to be purely mathematical, right? This was a huge moment that from then on, we're going to have a purely mathematical science. This was perhaps the biggest intellectual philosophical innovation in the scientific revolution. But Galileo understood quite well that you can't capture conscious experience in mathematical terms. Because conscious experience involves qualities, the smell of coffee, the taste of mint, the redness of a sunset. These qualities can't be captured in the purely quantitative language of mathematics. An equation can't capture that deep red you experience as you watch the setting sun. Right? So Galileo said, right, well, if we want a mathematical science, we've got to take consciousness out of science. So that's in the soul. That's outside of science. Once we do that, we can capture everything else. Purely mathematically. Brilliant move. That has gone really well. Produced, made incredible progress, produced incredible technology. I think 400 years later, we're at this period of history where people think, oh, it's gone so well. It's gone so well. It's surely explaining everything. Well, no, hold on. It's gone so well because it was designed to exclude consciousness, right? I think if Galileo were to time travel to the present day and hear about, oh, this troubles explaining consciousness in the terms of physical science, he'd say, of course, I bloody designed physical science to exclude consciousness. That's the very point. So I think if we want to really bring consciousness into science, we need to find a way of unifying what Galileo separated. This is why we're having so much trouble. We need to find a way of unifying what Galileo separated. The qualitative story of human consciousness, colors, sounds, smells, tastes, and the quantitative story of physical science. And I think panpsychism offers a way of doing that.
Okay, so we have the fine-tuned universe hypothesis. Let's say it's true. We have the consciousness. We talked about panpsychism. With all of these in place, forgive me, but I still can't quite see how that makes the universe have a purpose. Couldn't everything just be a giant fluke? Maybe I'm guided by my intuition too much here, but do you ever have one of those weird existential moments when you're just like eating a sandwich or something and a sort of a wave comes over you, just a feeling telling you this is all a big misunderstanding, like a big accident, because it's just too odd to be anything else. And there's really no other possible explanation than all of this being a freak accident. Or is that just me?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, the purpose stuff comes from the fine tuning. So more than the consciousness issue. So let's come back to the fine tuning, right? This surprising discovery that certain numbers in physics are against incredible odds, just right for life. So Zaza, as you vividly put it there, well, maybe it's just a fluke, right? Flukes happen, you know,
Yeah. Sometimes people do win at the casino.
Or you're thinking of someone and they phone, or I have a wonderful picture in my book that my wife drew. My wife, Emma Bullock, does all the illustrations of my book. She did a wonderful picture of Jesus in toast. You know, if you Google it, you get these times you've got I say Jesus, or, you know, the Western idea of Jesus, I guess, in certain films or certain, well, I guess.
The Jared Leto Jesus.
Paintings. Yeah. But you know, you don't say, oh my God, Jesus is communicating through us through toast. Is that just a fluke? Well, you know, I think that is a rational thing to say when it's not that improbable, right? But let me take another example. Suppose some burglars break into a bank, right? And there's a 20-digit combination and they guess it first time in like 5 seconds. And we're considering two possibilities, right? Hypothesis one, they had inside information and they were told. Hypothesis two, they just guessed it, you know, they got it right. What are you going to think, right? You're not going to say, I suggest it would be profoundly irrational to say, oh, well, maybe they just guessed, you know? No, look, right. That is incredibly improbable. And there's an alternative here that removes that improbability. I essentially think it's the same with the fine tuning case, right? We've got two hypotheses, right? It's just chance. Well, setting aside the multiverse, we've talked about that. Obviously, we can still debate that, but setting that aside, okay, it's just chance against these incredible odds, and they really are, you know, more than astronomical odds. It's that you're going to get these numbers right just by chance. Or maybe it's just chance, but I think there are alternative options that remove all that improbability. And therefore, I think the rational thing to do is to go for those alternatives. You know, it's not rational to believe improbable things. It's not kind of brave to believe improbable things. And this can be made more precise, actually, with we do actually have a mathematically precise way of understanding how evidence works with something called Bayes' theorem, which was very important in tracking the pandemic. I was very happy I wasn't happy during the pandemic, but I remember in the Guardian newspaper, they had an image of Bayes' theorem because they had an article on how important this was in tracking the pandemic. But yeah, basically Bayes' theorem tells us, slightly oversimplifying, but all things being equal, you go for the hypothesis that removes improbability, that makes the evidence most likely. Right. So just like if our evidence is the bank robbers got the right 20-digit code, well, you go for the theory that makes that likely, that, like, you know, they got inside information. Likewise, when we're thinking of the fine tuning physics for life, to avoid the incredible improbability that this is just chance, I think we need to go for some sort of hypothesis. And I think there are rigorous hypotheses where there is actually some kind of goal-directedness towards life in that very early stage of the universe. And I think really the reason we're not doing that is cultural, I think. We've just got used to the idea, oh no, science, that sounds too goddish. Science has ruled that out. Science, you know, that's a load of rubbish. And then the evidence changes, but when we still don't want to go near it because we've just got to feel icky about it. But I think there are ways of making sense of that there's some kind of goal-directedness towards life. It makes the evidence we are finding more probable. It explains that evidence. I really think that's the rational thing to go for. And I think we're kind of a little bit in denial about it as a society. I think future historians will look back and think, why the hell did they ignore this fine-tuning stuff for so long? That's what I think.
How is universe with a purpose different from intelligent design? Could you clear that up for us, please?
Well, what I should quickly say is, although I do have issues with traditional atheist view that we live in a meaningless, purposeless universe for the reasons I've just been explaining, I also have big problems with the traditional idea of God as an all-knowing, all-powerful, perfectly good being. I have issues there with the familiar problem of suffering. Why wouldn't loving God who can do anything choose to bring us into existence with the horrific process of evolution by natural selection. So I have problems with the traditional idea of God. I think there's things that can't explain, like suffering. But I also have problems with traditional atheism. I think there's things it can't explain, like fine-tuning. And, you know, we're stuck in this perennial debate, you know, who's right, Richard Dawkins or the Pope? Which team are you on? When I think actually both sides of this never-ending debate get something right and something wrong. And it's just high time we explored the middle ground options, which is what I tried to do in my modestly titled book, Why the Purpose of the Universe.
And just again, like, so intelligent design means that there is a God who created the universe, and the God is all powerful and all knowing, and everything else follows from that. But it doesn't square up with what we're observing about the universe.
Yeah. What does intelligent design mean? Often that term is used for theories where we need some kind of designer in biology. And that's certainly not what I'm suggesting. I'm not a biologist. I'm happy to defer to the consensus of biologists about the best explanation of what's going on in biology. But I'm not opposed to some kind of designer. And you know, that is a natural way of making sense of goal-directedness, right? There's some kind of mind. I would want it to be a non-anthropomorphic, very, very different mind to us, to a human evolved mind. But yeah, there could be one explanation I'm open to is some kind of mind behind the universe. So that's, you know, close to the traditional God idea. But I would not go for an all-powerful mind, right? Or at least not all-powerful and perfectly good, right? Because that leads us back to the problem of suffering. So basically, in the Why book, I consider three different ways of making sense of goal-directedness. One is a non-standard designer, maybe a god of limited powers, who's kind of made the best universe they can, right? They maybe God just can't create intelligent life in an instant. Maybe the only way God can create intelligent life is to create a universe with the right physics that will eventually evolve life. And God's like, oh God, I'm sorry, it's really messy. I wish I could do better, but it's this or nothing, right? This is the best I could do. So this hypothesis could explain both the fine-tuning in terms of God's purposes, but also the suffering in terms of God's limitations. So that's one possibility. I also explore just taking goal-directedness as a brute without some mind to underlie it. We could have goal-directed laws, or we call these teleological laws with kind of purposes built into them, sort of aiming at some future goal. And actually some of our best, very rigorous philosophers have found a kind of very rigorous, precise way of making sense of articulating such goal-directed laws. Third possibility, as a panpsychist who already thinks the universe is filled with consciousness, I explore the possibility that the universe is itself, in some sense, a conscious mind with its own goal-directedness. And these sound kind of very weird, strange, unusual hypotheses, but I think we can make very precise sense of them. I think we can, the evidence, for example, of fine-tuning supports them. And then at that point, it's just cultural prejudice that is making us think, oh, this is stupid, this is really weird. Well, you know, tell me what's wrong. Tell me where the evidence is going wrong.
Don't some of these options kind of open more questions than they answer them? Like, for example, if there is a mind that's kind of directing or creating the universe, who put the mind there? Where does the mind come from? What's the mind's purpose then?
Well, look, every hypothesis has to stop somewhere, right? I often quote I don't like Wittgenstein as a philosopher. He's a great philosopher, but I don't really like it. But I love this line he gives that I give a lot. Explanation has to stop somewhere, right? Every theory has to take something as the starting point. Maybe you take the Big Bang as starting point. Maybe the laws of physics. Maybe the quantum vacuum. Maybe mathematics. Maybe God. So I don't see the problem with taking a god of some kind as a starting point, as long, you know, what do we want out of theory? We want it to explain the data that we think needs explaining, and we want it to be fairly simple, not too complicated. And I think if we can give some kind of hypothesis where there is some sort of mind or goal-directedness behind things, and that can be articulated in a not too complicated way, and then we say, well, you know, what's your justification for this starting point? Well, it deals with the fine-tuning, and it can also explain the suffering we find because of this mind has limitations, or these goal-directed processes have certain limitations in their realization. Then, you know, I think that's all you ever want from a scientific or a philosophical proposal.
That does make sense. But I don't know where I heard this this phrase, God of the gaps, that once you put God as an explanation, he fills up the gaps of everything that we don't know. And then we just sort of stop trying because we don't need anything else.
Yeah, I would say this isn't God of the gaps. God of the gaps, I mean, it's an important thing to be wary of. God of the gaps is where you say, I don't understand this, therefore God did it. You know, I don't understand dark matter, therefore God made it. But this is not what we're doing here. This is saying, look, something God-ish is supported by this empirical evidence. And as I say, we have a mathematically precise way of understanding how evidence works. We get evidential support when the hypothesis makes the evidence likely, right? That's how Bayes' theorem works. We go for the hypothesis that makes the evidence likely. So the argument is some sort of God-ish hypothesis makes the fine-tuning kind of likely, kind of expected, whereas a sort of chance hypothesis makes the fine-tuning incredibly unlikely. And if those two statements I've just said are correct, then Bayes' theorem kind of mechanically churns out that you've got support for God. And so, you know, in a way, when I teach philosophy of religion and they think they're going to give all their sort of Richard Dawkins, the students think they're going to give the Richard Dawkins style intuitions and stuff, these kind, and I make them do Bayes' theorem. I make them do probability calculus, and it sort of disciplines the debate. There's still debate to be had. There's still a debate to be had, but we work within our mathematical understanding of how evidence works. So you know, sometimes we need to be wary of biases, right? But I think there's a problem at the moment in that we're very well trained in Western intellectual circles to be aware of religious biases, you know? That's important. But there's also secular biases, you know? Every generation absorbs a worldview it can't see beyond, right? I feel silly talking about this stuff in front of my peers as a philosophy professor, you know, talking about kind of a purpose to the universe. I feel stupid, right? And that kind of groupthink bias stops us looking at things impartially, right? So I talk to a lot of physicists about that. I talk more and more to loads and loads of physicists. And a lot of them say, yeah, look, there is a deep problem in this fine-tuning evidence we're talking about is not like fringe controversial evidence. It's very broadly accepted. But they say, well, you know, and the evidence will change. Just give it time. You know, the future physics won't have fine tuning in. Well, maybe we'll get, you know, we'll bring gravity, general relativity and quantum mechanics together and there won't be any fine tuning. Maybe there'll be more, you know, all you can ever do is work with the evidence you currently have. And it's the very definition of a bias to say, well, I'm going to ignore the evidence we currently have until we get evidence that, you know, fits better with the theory I like. And I think that's what almost everybody is doing at the moment with fine tuning. We've got this evidence that fits really well with something God-ish, so we're just ignoring it until some different evidence comes along.
I like how you say something God-ish. So you're allowing for a lot of different possibilities. You're not saying this God or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the very generic way I'd say it is some kind of goal-directedness towards life. Maybe goal-directed laws of nature. But I reject the traditional God as much as the atheistic position. But yeah, so we need to be open-minded. But I think we currently have evidence, and we need to be open-minded that the evidence will change. Maybe it'll change. But at the moment, there is evidence for some kind of goal-directedness towards life in the early universe, I believe.
Well, since I am full of secular biases, I am an atheist, or maybe an agnostic would be more fair. I'm just going to try to throw everything that I have, which is not a lot, at you. What do you think of the simulation hypothesis? Wouldn't that also solve many of the questions that we've addressed?
Oh, yeah, that should be an option on the table as well. Yeah, that's a designer. Right. So the simulation hypothesis that we're in, and I consider this in detail in the book, that we're in some computer simulation, you know, maybe it's not a bad guy or a good guy, someone, you know, trying to work out how life evolves in intricate detail. So they set up this computer simulation and we're just in there. So yeah, that's a design hypothesis. I mean, ultimately, I guess I have issues because of my consciousness views with whether beings in a simulation would be conscious. I think you tend to think beings in a simulation would be conscious if you have a view of consciousness where it's more just sort of information processing kind of thing, you know, then, you know, if the simulation is really that detailed that all the structure of the brain is preserved in the simulation, then you're sort of going to have the same information processing. Maybe you're going to have the same consciousness. But if, as a panpsychist, I think consciousness is sort of the stuff of the world, the flesh and blood of the world, then I don't really think a simulated system is going to be conscious in the same way. So that's one issue I have with the simulation hypothesis. But yeah, no, my friend, the philosopher Richard Brown, who's got a good YouTube channel, Consciousness Live, I think it's called. He's very passionate on that being the best explanation of fine tuning. We aspire to have a conference one day on sort of God versus simulation, which is the best explanation of fine tuning. But yeah, that should be on the table, sure.
Okay, I'm tapped out. that's all I had.
But don't just say like, oh, that's got to be it. You know, I think we should be open to all of these possibilities, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
Carry on. Fair. No. I wanted to ask, okay, so if the universe indeed does have a purpose, what is it? The big question follows. How can we begin to grapple with this question if the answer to the first one is affirmative?
Well, you have to buy the book to find out. The final page, it says the purpose. No, of course, that's not settled at all by this fine-tuning business we've been discussing. I mean, it could be we've reached the end of the purpose. Maybe the purpose was kind of evolve life or something, and that's it, and the purpose has run out. On the other hand, you might think, it would be surprising if there is a purpose to the universe. If there is a purpose, it would kind of be surprising. Oh, we happen to be living at the final period of the history, you know, the purpose of the universe. So maybe there's more to come. Maybe there's some greater form of existence to come that, relative to that, we're like our existence relative to worms. But yeah, I mean, it's very speculative, I suppose. I mean, what I ended the book with, I suppose, is that one could, in terms of thinking about, you know, most of the book is just the kind of cold-blooded argument, but then the last chapter is thinking about how this implications for human meaning and purpose. And I talk about what one could live in hope that there is some greater purpose to come. There is some continuity of this purpose, and that maybe even we can contribute in some small way. The good we do may in some way contribute to the coming about of this greater purpose. And at this point, it's going to be hope rather than belief, you know, it's living in hope of something. But I think that can be rational. I'm a big fan of the great 19th century philosopher and psychologist William James, you know, who talks about in situations of uncertainty, it can be rational to sort of choose to believe, to choose to have faith. I mean, take an example I like to give. Are we going to deal with climate change? You know, you might think probably not, looking at the evidence, or at least it's very far from certain. But it could be rational to think, well, look, I'm going to choose to have faith that we are. I'm going to live in hope that we're going to deal with it, you know, and that's going to give me meaning and motivation. So in situations of uncertainty, you know, so far I've been saying this is what we should think because this is where the evidence points. But now we're going beyond that, saying in situations of uncertainty, maybe it can be possible to live in hope of something. But it's very uncertain. Well, more recently even than the book, I've come to the conclusion that a certain slightly heretical version of Christianity fits quite well with all this stuff. And so I've gone public embracing, self-identifying as a heretical Christian. But that's much less, but again, to emphasize the same point, that would all be very uncertain, right? Well, I've come to think that this slightly unusual form of Christianity is a credible possibility because I think it fits quite well with the God of limited powers hypothesis I articulated before. So I think if something's a credible possibility, then it can be a rational option to live in hope that it's true. But certainly I always want to emphasize this is very uncertain.
Yeah, so this is quite a bombshell, your article, My Leap Across the Chasm, in which you articulate how a sort of, like you said, a heretical form of Christianity makes sense to you. Could you talk more about this heretical form of Christianity? What happened? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's a good title, isn't it? I didn't come up with that title. That was the, often, generally when you write things for magazines, Generally, when you write things in magazines, the editors come up with the title. I particularly like that one.
It's really good, yeah. Very, very catchy.
Well, it's a form of Christianity that fits well with how the Eastern Orthodox Church thinks about things. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, there's less of a focus on sin, right? We've got wrapped up with that because of Augustine. And in the Eastern Orthodox Church, the ultimate goal of existence is for God and the universe to come into a state of deep, intimate unity. That this is what Jesus was getting at when he talks about this metaphor of vine and the branches, right? Think about the relationship between the vine and its branches. Obviously, that's a very deep, intimate, organic relationship. So the aim is that that's the ultimate goal of existence for us and God, to come together in this intimate organic connection. But there's a problem, right? We're a bit different to God, right? Don't know about you, Zara, but you know, God's sort of like the timeless, what's God? Timeless source of everything that is and was and will be. And we're just these kind of physical, contingent, embodied beings, right? And the two kind of don't fit together. Robin Collins, someone who defends this, says it's like trying to graft a branch onto a horse. They kind of don't fit together. So the aim is for God and the universe to come together, but they're just too different. So what's the solution? The solution is for God to become a bit more like us. Take on a physical nature, share in our form of existence so that we can share in God's form of existence. The thought is that this begins to close the gap between God and creation. So basically, I thought when I learnt about this, you know, reading and talking to many different Christian thinkers, firstly, it strikes me as it resonates with me in a much deeper way, in a way that the Catholicism of my upbringing never resonated, and I rejected when I was 14, and you know, and all these kind of Jesus paying the price for our sins just kind of makes no sense to me on an intellectual or spiritual level. But this way of thinking about things strikes, it spiritually resonates with me. And it seems to me to fit quite well with this hypothesis of a God of limited powers. Although the Eastern Orthodox Church, I'm not saying they believe in a God of limited powers. This is why my view is heretical, partly. But so the way I interpret Christianity basically is, you know, God's trying to create a perfect universe, but the only way God can do that is kind of in two stages. Firstly, creating a kind of okay universe with the right physics to eventually evolve life. And then when it's evolved enough, God kind of brings it to perfection by becoming more intimately involved in it, sharing in its nature, so it shares in God's nature and so on. So this, I'm very uncertain that it's true, as I've said, but I would say it's a credible possibility because it fits quite well with a view I think is strongly evidenced, namely the hypothesis of a God of limited powers, or that's one of the possible explanations of this fine-tuning, which is, I think, a serious piece of evidence.
When we were talking about the universe and how it's filled with suffering and, you know, with other terrifying stuff and phenomena and so forth, wouldn't an evil God also solve this problem? What if the God is there, but they're just evil?
Yeah, well, again, that should be on the table in terms of the general middle ways between God and atheism. That should be on the table. I suppose the problem I have with an evil God is it seems to lead to the mirror images of the problems with the all-powerful good God, right? So the problem with the all-powerful good God is, oh, why is there so much suffering? But conversely, for the evil God, why are there so many good things, right? Why is there beauty and babies and love and everything? Now, you could make up explanations, I suppose. Maybe we're just having good things, so the suffering is even worse when we get the good things taken away or something. But they end up sounding a little bit like the explanations, which I think are bad explanations, people try to give to explain why the good God allows suffering. So this has been pressed very forcefully by Stephen Law, what he calls the evil God challenge. Maybe you could say, well, it's a God that's kind of good, but kind of bad. But I don't know, we'd have to be more precise about how to articulate that. You know, what is it, God who gets angry? Or I don't know. So I think what I like about a good God that's limited is I think actually we can very precisely specify the limitations. You just take physics, take the numbers out. That will give you a kind of mathematical structure that's quite kind of simple. And you say, you know, God's limited to physics with a form like that. So basically the specification of the limitations of God is simpler than physics. So that's nice. I don't know. I don't know how you tell as simple a story with a bad God about like why we have the suffering we have.
And last question before I finally admit defeat. Why doesn't God reveal themselves? Even if it's a limited God, a God of limited powers, God was capable enough to create this universe and us in it. So surely they can reveal themselves to us. Not in just these sort of like literary appearances, but in a way that we'd all understand what's going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a very important challenge called the hiddenness of God. Why doesn't God make herself more known? And it's a very important part of why I don't believe in the traditional God. It's been pressed very forcefully by John Schellenberg, probably the most famous proponent of this objection, who I had at a conference here in Durham, my university, last weekend on panpsychism and panentheism. Panentheism being the view that kind of the universe is inside God. And John Schellenberg has not only pressed that objection against the traditional God, but he also has his own brand of unusual religion. He thinks we're very early in our evolutionary history, so we should think, He does believe in something kind of like something godish, but he thinks, you know, it's too early in our evolutionary history to know the true religion. We're going to have to wait another few 100,000 years before we know the true religion. It's a very interesting perspective.
Anyway, I don't have a couple of million years.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, to address your, I mean, I address all of these challenges to the traditional God by saying about God's limitations. So I think, yeah, I think God can't reveal themselves more precisely. So I guess I want to say we experience God in some way in spiritual experiences, mystical experiences. But I think God is limited in just providing some very generic sense of her essence, her presence, that can only be grasped, you know, when you're in the right frame of mind, you know, maybe after a lot of meditating or great experience of beauty or taking some psychedelics or something. You know, it's hard to discern in the hustle and bustle of ordinary life, and God kind of can't break through that. But also, I think God can't convey more detail than that. I think God's limited to just conveying some very generic sense of a greater reality at the core of things, which so many people do believe in, right? Even today, with the decline of religion in the West, so many people do say, I don't believe in God, but I believe in something. And I think that is the God conveying her existence to people. So why do I think God's limited in that way? For exactly the reason you think, you know, if God could convey her existence more precisely, I think she would. I mean, things get trickier if you go for Christianity, right? Even the heretical version I've given holds that in some sense, you know, God and the universe came together in a quite unique way in the Jesus guy. Well, how come God's able to do that? Why doesn't God do it more often? That's tricky. And I've got a long academic paper that's currently under review, actually, trying to articulate why that could be, you know, to make sense of how you'd extend God's powers to make sense of God's capacity to become deeply unified with a sort of human being in a way that still denies God the ability to make the world better than it is. So I admit that's very, very tricky, right? And that's partly why I'm very, very uncertain that Christianity is true, right? I engage with Christianity as, I think of faith as a matter of trust, right? It's trusting a certain view of the meaning of existence to, in terms of how you interpret your deepest experiences, shape your life goals, engage with community and spiritual practice. And it's fine to do all that, engage with a religious tradition while being very, on an intellectual level, realizing it's very uncertain. So yeah, so I'm very uncertain that Christianity is true, that the Christianity I engage with, but to the more generic problem of God communicating, I would just say, I think that's simpler. I think, I mean, all of this is hard, but I just think God's not able to do that.
Last question. You kind of touched on it already. But if the universe does have a purpose, what implications does that have for us? In other words, what's the best way to lead our lives? I'm just going to press you on it a little bit.
So I take a middle way option. I'm always the middle way guy.
The centrist. You
know, one extreme. Oh, actually, I'm quite lefty politically though. So
nice.
Yeah, I don't like that. But although I'm still kind of, I think I would have been a centrist politically in the 70s.
And oh, I think
the
that's an interesting way of framing
years.
It.
Yeah, this is interesting. I've got the post from 45 to 70, 75. I think if I'd have lived in that period, I would have been pretty centrist.
Which is like a communist now.
Exactly. The economic thing has gone so far right that, yes, if you have that kind of view that used to be held in the Conservative Party here, you're a radical leftist. You know, I've got a friend in his 70s who was an old school conservative pre-Thatcher, and his economic views are the radical left of the Labour Party with Jeremy Corbyn. Anyway, we're digressing. the meaning, the purpose of existence.
Yeah, the best way to lead our lives.
One extreme view is, you know, if there's no purpose to the universe, it's all pointless. Yeah, you know, we might as well just kill ourselves. Another extreme is a certain secular humanist view that says, probably no purpose to the universe, but even if there is, it's irrelevant. We make our own meaning and purpose. That's the end of it. So I have a middle way view. I think you can have a perfectly meaningful life independent of there being a purpose to the universe if you pursue things that are worth doing. Kindness, creativity, the pursuit of knowledge, and so on. But I'm inclined to think there's the potential for greater purpose, greater meaning, if there is a purpose to the universe. If, you know, we want our lives to make a difference. If you can contribute in some small way to the purposes of the whole of reality, that's fucking massive. That's about as big as you can imagine. On the other hand, that comes with risks, right? The risk, maybe it's not true. Maybe I'm sort of living for something that just turns out to be false. So that needs to be balanced. And I would encourage lots of experiments in living. Let's stop being so ideological, like this side is obviously right, this side is obviously wrong. Let's be a bit uncertain, a bit heretical. Try different things out. And I'm trying out this weird form of Christianity. I feel quite happy, actually. So maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, making me happy. So that's all right.
Awesome. Professor Goff, thank you so much. Where can people find your books? Find bookstores everywhere?
Oh, yeah. Only good bookstores. There's only about two of them that sell it, but they're the good ones. I don't know. My website, philipgoffphilosophy.com. Spend a lot of time arguing on Twitter, philip_goff, philip with one L. I've just joined Blue Sky today because, yeah, I lost like 2,000 Twitter followers in the last week because everyone's mass leaving Twitter after the US election. So I'm going to do both. I don't want to just be talking to people who agree with me. So I'm on Blue Sky as just Philip Goff. Got a podcast, Mind Chat, where I argue with someone who has the polar opposite opinions to me. He doesn't believe any of this religious bullshit, or, you know, he doesn't think consciousness exists, at least in the way I talk about it. So, yeah, that's about it, really.
Thanks again for this incredibly illuminating and mind-bending conversation. I really, really thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope we get to do this again.
Thank you very much. It's fun.
Thank you for listening. I really, really appreciate it. Again, this podcast has no sponsors, no production team, and no editors. It's just little old me, and as such, I'm at the mercy of you lovely folks watching and listening. So please do subscribe on YouTube, click that little bell thing or whatever it helps. Follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts if you can. Also, I don't want to sell you like an atrocious t-shirt that you don't really need. So if you can, and most of all, if you want, of course, please support me on Patreon. And here I have to express my eternal gratitude to my patrons on Patreon, aka the producers of this show. As always, without you, tovarishi and tovarishice, this show simply would not exist at all. So a massive thank you to Goran Ivasic, Anže Sever, Ole, Marin Ferrara, Aljaš, Štrole, Aida, Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinjo, Goran, Gordan, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen, Veronika, and Taichi. You guys are the best.